From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. In their epic book on the life of Vincent van Gogh, Gregory White Smith and Stephen Nafee say the artist was a victim of his own fanatic heart. Van Gogh's fervor and much of his art is often explained as the product of a diseased mind, but the book reveals there is so much more that helps understand his unbending demands and his unending problems. His brother Theo said to see his paintings as Vincent saw them, you had to get to know him from the inside, which is precisely what Smith and Nafee have attempted to do. Gregory White Smith is our guest today to take us through their decade-long exploration into Van Gogh's life and to try and help us understand what Vincent saw. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For 10 years, the writers Gregory White Smith and Stephen Nafee explored the life of the artist Vincent van Gogh. They pored over letters and papers and paintings, and over time it became more than just a project. It was an enterprise. They employed a team of researchers, and along the way they uncovered new documents. And much of the attention for the book has come, of course, with the news they broke, with this theory that van Gogh, in fact, didn't commit suicide. Vincent van Gogh, they say, did everything with a kind of urgent fury that transformed him from a boy of inexplicable fierceness into a wayward, battered soul. The book is an exacting but an intimate portrait of van Gogh that attempts to discern the essence of what made him so intense. Van Gogh himself describes that urgency as the it. We're going to be talking about van Gogh's paintings as we go along on the show, and we're going to be posting these images online on our website at KUER.org/Radio West. Along with Stephen Nafee, Gregory White Smith is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a biography of Jackson Pollock. Their other books include The Mormon Murders and A Stranger in the Family. Gregory White Smith is joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Gregory White Smith, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Doug, for having me.
Well, as I said, you spent 10 years with this subject. You and Stephen have talked about that work as this, you know, this project, the years of research, and then the time that you spent writing. I wanted to ask you this, though. How did you think about Vincent van Gogh when you began, and how does that compare to where you ended up?
Well, we had in our heads the same myth that everyone else does, the same legend. Van Gogh has this iconic status in Western art, and is, I think, undoubtedly the best known and the most beloved artist that almost anyone can name. And his reputation, we found, extends onto every continent. And if they know nothing else, they know the name. They know he cut off his ear, and they know he killed himself. And those key aspects of his biography and his joyous art are really part of our sort of our cultural legacy as humans.
It's part of the legacy. So you had the myth, and then you, and we'll talk about where you came around to who Vincent van Gogh actually was as we go. His brother Theo said that if you wanted to try and understand what Vincent saw in his own paintings, you had to know him from the inside. And I suppose that's what you were getting at in the book.
That's exactly what we were getting at. The challenge in doing a biography of an art, any biography of an artist, is to try to understand where is the art coming from in the artist's life. And that was certainly the challenge with Vincent. And it was, in Vincent's case, made more compelling, I won't say easier, but more harder in a way by the fact that he had written so copiously, letters, almost 1,000 letters, often long letters, about what he was doing, about his relationship with his brother, and that presented both a tremendous treasure of research, but also a tremendous mountain of information to absorb and understand.
It's not the first artist that you've written about. We mentioned Jackson Pollock, the piece you won the Pulitzer for. Another troubled and difficult man. You've been asked before, how You know, you spent 10 years with Vincent van Gogh, another kind of unpleasant guy in some ways. Is that hard?
No, that's it is hard. I would say it was harder with Pollock. It was harder with Pollock because Pollock was, in some ways, a less sympathetic figure. Yeah. Vincent was incredibly difficult. He was ornery. He was stubborn. He was aggressive. He was argumentative. And yet, he through the letters, you sense that he's he's a deeply troubled heart, and that is you become sympathetic with him. And I hope and I think the book tries to get at that core of sympathy and understand why he said about his own art that he described it as heartbroken art, and it was heartbroken because. It came from a heartbroken heart. And so that connection was right there, and he himself admitted it, whereas in Pollock's case, he was much more, because he was in a different artistic world, he wanted to believe that his art was all about the art and that his own personal life had nothing to do with it.
I think you've said for Vincent van Gogh, he was hard to like but easy to love.
Right, right. Exactly, and he made himself difficult, partly out of defensiveness, partly because he wanted to preempt criticism. So he was often the first one to say, "My critics will say X, Y, or Z," and they're full of baloney. And here are the reasons why. So you will get the whole argument, sometimes in three or four parts. In a letter where he'll imagine what his uncles will say about him, and then he'll put up a defense, and then he'll imagine what his uncles say to that defense, and then he'll come up with a defense to that. And so these arguments are unfolding in his head all the time. And people who knew him or visited him said it was often like dropping into the middle of an argument.
One thing you write in the book that helped me understand Van Gogh was that he lived, you wrote, with the unsparing rules of youth, that he hadn't put away those passions and those ideals that we all do when we grow up.
Right.
There was urgency like he was a child.
He was. And there are a couple of things interesting about that. One is we think of childhood as a time of tempestuous emotions.
Yeah.
And those emotions swept in and out of his life constantly from the time he was a child to the time he died. And of course, it didn't work for him as a child either. His friends and people who knew him considered him a strange boy. And later in life, he alienated his fellow artists. He had trouble finding a place in any of the many schools that were running around France at the time. And so really was forced by his own personality into creating his own kind of art.
This may be kind of pointless speculation, but I wonder, had Vincent van Gogh not died fairly young at 37, do you think he would have remained a painter? Because it goes to something that you wrote about van Gogh, you know, roaming this, I think you say, this mysterious and varied path in his very short life. I mean, he was an art dealer for a while. He tried to enter the clergy, and all of this we'll sort of get to. I mean, he did magazine illustration. Right. But and here's how you put it in the book. He had a blazingly short career as a painter, which is interesting.
Yeah. I think, you know, his entire painting career was the last decade of his life.
Yeah.
And he had those previous careers you mentioned. But what they all have in common is his desire to reach out to people and touch them in some way, and both console himself and console them in the process, console others in the process. So I think that urge, which is what drove all those careers, well, he found its fulfillment in his artistic career. The question, I don't think, it's pretty clear he would have continued to be an artist if he could have supported himself and could have gotten Theo to continue to support him. But his art would have changed. He was going more and more toward a inner-directed personal art that probably would have gotten more abstract, probably would have gotten more colorful. And in some ways, the Fauvists took Van Gogh's art and took it to its further extreme, and I think he probably would have headed in that direction.
Yeah, well, it's interesting when you think about it, his art later in life becoming more sort of inner-directed. I mean, it's interesting how he studied art himself. I mean, you write about how he collected artists' biographies, and the thing that interested him, it seems like, in the pictures that he saw, wasn't just, you know, the technique or the painting itself. He said, I love the man. The artist. Yeah.
This was something he picked up from Zola, but always felt. He collected snippets of biography and rumors and what they used to call chats with artists, and was constantly, his feeling was certainly you really couldn't fully understand the art without understanding the artist. And we certainly believe that, and he certainly believed that, and his brother believed that. And so he painted in that sort of mindset, and he really did see his art as a way of connecting with other people, basically putting himself out there, not just his art, but putting himself out there. And so if they liked his art, then that was a great affirmation of himself in a life that was in just unspeakably lonely.
His desire to learn, it's interesting you write about, I mean, how intensely he studied. And I'm wondering, did he see himself as a gifted painter? Did he see this as natural ability, or did he see this as something he had to, you know, earn, work for?
I think one thing he did not have was the easy facility that we often associate with sort of born artists. Yeah. He could not make likenesses, is what he called it, and he sort of disparagingly referred to making a likeness. So he had a real problem with that, and it was that inability to do what was academically appropriate and, in fact, necessary to get through art school, which he tried several times to do, that drove him to create. He had such a bursting need to express himself that somebody else, a less determined personality, would have said, "Well, I guess I'm just not an artist," and gone off and done something else. But he was so determined that he just persisted and created these new forms, new ways of painting, new ways of applying paint, new ways of combining color, new ways of using line that were his own.
Yeah.
And just instead of resigning himself to the fact that he was just not an artist because he couldn't do it, he just redefined art in a way that he could do. And in some ways, no one ever did better.
I have this image of him going into his uncle's store, where he's just going through magazine after magazine, talking about how he finds these old friends.
Yeah, I know. He had a couple of things. He had an incredibly good eye, and he had a memory like a steel trap. So he could remember images he had seen years before in tremendous detail. And there are wonderful passages in the letters where he recalls a trip to the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam and a particular Hals painting and the exact tonalities of the satin dress and the grays of the face and the white. I mean, it's just astonishing. He installed these certain images in his musée imaginaire and kept them there forever. Could summon them in the most beautiful descriptions you can imagine. It's one of the great pleasures of reading the letters, and there are many burdens to reading the letters, but there's the great pleasures are when he describes art.
When you're looking at those letters, Gregory Whitesmith, do you see the intensity? Do you see how he's grasping a pen? Does he get more urgent? Do the letters run together when you sense he's getting excited?
Absolutely. There are places where the letters, he'll send a letter a day or two letters a day, and it's as though he were writing and writing and writing and writing and then filled a sheet and then immediately grabbed the next sheet and started all over again and started writing again. That was one of the sort of key characteristics of both his personality and his art, was this incredible exhortatory imperative he felt to convince you. He really, and this was usually it was in the case of convincing his brother that he was on the right track. So when he was an illustrator and painting these really rather cheerless subjects of orphan men and peasants on the street and that sort of thing. And his brother kept telling him, oh, really, you know, you should do something more cheerful. Have you heard of the Impressionists and how they use color? And wouldn't it be nice to use color? And he would say, no, I want to do black and white. And in fact, I'm engaged in a search to find the blackest black I can find.
Right.
And so there was kind of, it was both an artistic journey, but it was also, to a certain extent, as part of his ongoing friction with his brother. He was, even though they obviously loved each other, and Theo was incredibly faithful and dutiful toward Vincent. He also, Vincent was at a level resentful of the fact that he, as the older brother, had lost his job at the gallery where Theo became tremendously successful and made all the money that supported not only Vincent but supported his whole family. So he felt like Vincent had, Theo had usurped his position as the elder brother, and that made him feel ashamed. And that, of course, generated a lot of negative feelings.
It seems like in some ways it's not just a book about Vincent. It's also about Theo, that powerful bond. They were sort of one in some ways. He thought of it that way, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He thought of his art as being the sort of the progeny of the artistic bond he had with Theo. And one of the things that was the most interesting for us in doing this was to dig behind the... Everybody knows about how patient and supportive Theo was of Vincent's art and his career and the money that he constantly gave and Vincent constantly asked for. But the relationship was so much more complex than that. Like all family relationships, it had cross currents. It had love on one hand and envy on the other and resentment on the other. So it was a very, very complex, not only one of the sweetest and the most supportive fraternal relationships in the history of art, but also one of the most complicated, as all family relationships tend to be if you look deeply enough.
Mm. You know, we'll work our way, Gregory Whitesmith, to the end of both of their lives, because they kind of converge at the end, which has surprised me, I think, about Theo anyway, in a lot of ways. But I also like how you talk about Vincent, you know, as a really great older brother. I mean, there's this image you have of us early in the book where Vincent and Theo are in this attic room that they share, and they're talking, and Vincent is introducing him to, you know, his own passions about nature and about his ideas of God, and they were playful. I mean, I like that image too.
Yeah, that's they did form a bond. They were 4 years apart, and they formed a tremendous bond in childhood, and even late in life, when Vincent was a bit of an embarrassment to the family, and Theo was a very gentrified dealer in Paris.
Yeah.
He said, you know, there's no question I adore my brother. And he never lost that younger brother adulation that he knew as a child. And in some ways, it made it all the sadder as Vincent spun off into directions that Theo couldn't understand, being essentially very conventional in his personal life and his emotional life, although he had his share of mistresses. But that was fairly conventional at the time, too.
Sure.
But he was torn between his feelings of love and duty toward his older brother and yet this feeling that he was going down a path that would take him nowhere except to family embarrassment and self-destruction.
It's interesting. There's this moment you write about when Theo, he toys with this idea of setting off, you know, ditching his conventional job because he was feeling constrained at work, and this particular moment is during a love affair that's kind of becoming a little scandalous in the family, and he's thinking of just quitting it all and becoming an artist. And Vincent is encouraging him. He's saying, "Yeah, do this. You can do this." But in the end, Theo can't. He can't make the decision, and he backs out.
Yeah, well, what Theo wanted to do was all that disillusionment with his current job and his employers, he wanted to go to New York and start a dealership in New York, thinking there were a lot of American buyers who were coming on the market, And Vincent, who was living in this remote region, and he had gone off to the deepest, darkest, most the poorest region in the Netherlands called Drenthe,
yeah.
And was living on a heath just in this hovel. And he sent a whole series of beseeching letters to Theo saying, come join me on the heath and we'll paint together. And then when Theo said, well, you know, I do have this mistress, Theo said, well, bring her. We'll all paint.
Right.
And so he had throughout his life and died with his vision that somehow he and his brother would reunite, to your point earlier, reunite and create this family of artists that would, and the idea of painting brothers was just fascinated him to the end of his life. And it was very sad at the end when Theo married and completely destroyed that vision and was really, I think, one of the disillusionments that sort of set in motion the events of his death.
I'm trying to figure out if he was reckless or if he saw something else, you know, if there's something else in you know, his kind of brazen, aggressive nature. I mean, he told Theo, I think it was Theo that he mentioned this to in a letter, that there was safety in the very heart of danger.
Right, right. Yeah, great quote. He was, I think, you know, he also has had a lifetime history of self-mutilation, certainly, in the form of cutting off his ear.
Sure.
But self-mortification.
Yeah. Yeah.
He would go on long spells of starving himself. He would beat himself with sticks when he felt he had not he'd done something wrong or had not lived up to his duty. His art wasn't selling. So that sense of punishing himself and many of his worst episodes in places like the coal fields of Belgium, where he smeared himself with coal and ran around the moors barefoot in the winter, and in a sort of a Lear-like fashion, were, I think, a reflection of his sort of feeling that he had not done his duty, that he had not lived up to his hopes for himself, and that he was somehow to blame. And that came, of course, also came out of a family that was very, very harsh in its judgment on Vincent because he was so unconventional. And so, and he tortured his poor father, a pastor, with his arguments on behalf of secularism and criminality and things like that, the sort of modern French arguments, and to the point where the father died of a stroke, and the family blamed Vincent for the stroke and continued to. And I think at some level Vincent internalized that accusation and felt this tremendous weight of guilt his whole life. So at the end of his life, there was a feeling of, I deserve this.
It's interesting. He studied Shakespeare in particular. I mean, he read a lot. But you talk about how later in their life he focused on the history plays of Shakespeare, which seemed to have kind of, I don't know, helped him relate to what a dysfunctional family was like in some way.
I think that's true. That's nicely put. I wish we had put that in the book. He was partly, though, he was such a voracious reader. People don't realize just how he just read incredibly quickly, and he read vast amounts. So he would read like all of Balzac, and he would pick up one book of Zola's and then decide he wanted to read the entire oeuvre. And with Shakespeare, when he turned to the histories later in life, partly it was the one part of the bard's work that he hadn't read. So he thought, well, let me read the histories. So he had a first of all, he had a sense of innate sense of organization. So if you start something, you should do the whole thing. And so he just did great swaths of Dutch literature, French literature, German literature, English literature. He just devoured them. And one of the challenges as his biographer was to go back and read all of that material.
Wow.
To try to understand. Our feeling was, and we sort of came to this as this was happening over the 10 years, is that we were really writing the biography of an imagination, and we had to understand everything that went into that imagination, all the books and all the poems and all the art, in order to understand ultimately what came out of that imagination.
Gregory White Smith is with us. He and Stephen Nafee have co-written the book Van Gogh, The Life. You can see some images of Van Gogh's paintings on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation about a remarkable book, about a remarkable man. Gregory White Smith is joining us. He and Stephen Nafee have co-written an epic biography of Van Gogh. It's called Van Gogh, The Life. We're going to have images, by the way, on our website at KUER.org/Radio West. I wonder, Gregory White Smith, you talk about his, and for as long as anyone has talked about Van Gogh or his art or his work or his life, his impulsiveness, even his art, is dismissed, you know, as mental illness in some ways or some kind of physical condition. He had epilepsy, which we can talk about, but that doesn't seem a terribly satisfying of a way of describing Vincent Van Gogh's nature or his need for art. That seems part of the myth more than anything.
I agree. It's the problem is that in art biography in particular, there is an old strain of that to talk about the artist's life in regard to the art is to somehow diminish the art, and there is no more extreme example of that than to say that the artist was mentally ill. Because that, again, it reflects very badly on the art, that therefore the art must be a product of that mental illness.
Yeah.
And for a long time, the Van Gogh family was extremely protective of all of the information they had in their archives regarding his mental illness, because they were afraid that people would say, oh, this is just the art of a crazy man. But of course, that's not true. And we certainly don't believe that. But on the other hand, we do believe that his mental illness shaped his personality and shaped his imagination, and both of those in turn shaped his art, so that his art was basically a reflection of everything that he was, and one of those things was his mental illness.
Let's talk about the time he goes to Paris. He and Theo seem to really take everything in about that city, the drinking, the nostalgia for sordidness, as they said.
Right.
This was the avant-garde social life, and they lived it up, I guess it's fair to say.
They dove into it, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the one thing about that is that the traditional story, if you look in the old books about Vincent, you'll see that he came from the hinterlands, from the Netherlands. He was in the sort of rural part of the Netherlands, painting peasants. And then he spent a brief time in Antwerp, and then he came to Paris, and then he met all these great artists of the period. He met Toulouse-Lautrec, and he met Anquetin, and he met Bernard, and he met Gauguin. And he sort of belonged to that group and learned from them about the new art and that sort of thing. And it turns out that's just wrong.
Yeah.
That he was always an incredibly insular, alienated figure. And the hyper-stylish group of artists that we were talking about, who were very wry and ironic and well-educated and all had great facility with the pen, they really didn't know what to make of this Dutchman who was so passionate and so earnest and had these weird drawings of peasants that were completely unrelated to what they saw as the path of modern art, that he really had hardly any friends in Paris. And his brother tried to get him kicked out of the apartment they shared. What was so surprising to us as we did this is that the portrait that was often painted of Vincent in Paris was so inconsistent with the portrait of him before in Holland and afterward in southern France, where he was, the neighbors wouldn't talk to him and everybody thought he was crazy and they tried to get him committed, and then he actually did commit himself to an asylum.
Right.
So the reason that that Paris window was so obscure was that, of course, there were no letters between Vincent and his brother during that period because they lived together.
Yeah.
So for a long time, it was just a sort of black hole in Van Gogh history.
You know, it's interesting. He was influenced by Impressionism, of course, and color and pointillism and Seurat and all
Absolutely.
Of those things. But I'm really interested in that more insular part where he found his own way. And the influence of these Japanese prints seems really instructive, where he would take these pieces and he would draw these grids and trace them out. I mean, it was incredibly fastidious, and that seemed to have a really profound effect on. If you look at the paintings of those times, you know, that was him.
Yeah, it is interesting that he was that was a huge effort for him because he was a much more of a throw all of his effort into something and do it quickly than he was a meticulous. Make a tracing and then transfer the tracing to a larger size canvas, which is what he did with those Japanese prints you're talking about.
Yeah.
But Japanese prints, he found an inspiration for color. And he also found he was a part of the movement at the end of the 19th century that saw Japan as a primitive society. And this has to do with the disillusionment that the Europeans were having in general with their own society, with the world of bourgeois convention that they'd grown up with. They were disillusioned with their religion. They had had a very bad war in 1870, and they were being buffeted by technological change. And so they really were thinking that we've lost our souls. And in a search to refine those souls, they turned in a variety of places. They turned to rural parts of Europe where they thought there was some greater authenticity. And they turned to what they thought were primitive societies that were closer to what it was to be human in some sort of essential way. And for reasons that are hard to explain now, but at the time they thought of the Japanese as a primitive society and therefore closer to the essence of what it was to be human. And therefore both those things gave Vincent this manic love of Japanese prints, which he collected by the thousands, and as you say, made these vast paintings out of these small prints. But he colored them in his own way. He colored them and loaded them with heavy impasto, tremendous amount of brushwork, in order to make his arguments for color. On this template of the Japanese prints.
There were two issues that consumed his work, it seemed. One was religion, or as you put it, family reconciliation through religion.
Right.
And then there was art. I mean, these were the two kinds of things, and he was looking to meld those two.
He was looking to art to mend the first one. In other words, the second sort of the relationship between the two was he created the situation where he was alienated from his family and generally from people, spent whole stretches of his life in which the only person he ever talked to was the woman who saved him, who served him dinner.
Yeah.
And his only conversation was ordering a meal. And he looked to art as a way to sort of, as I said, bridge that gap and to reach out to people. And so that world of alienation out of which he came, he tried to build a bridge back to it by creating art that people would be touched by. And the most important thing to him, ultimately, was to create an emotional bond through his art. And what's fascinating to us is that that is precisely what he succeeded in doing.
Mm.
And the reason that he's so widely beloved, surely the most beloved artist in the Western canon, is that his art is such an emotional art. It reaches out to you in that way. It wants to be loved, and we love it.
Mm.
It's really, it's so it's such a direct connection between what he intended and the effect he had that he would be, I think, astonished if he came back and saw, and extremely happy that what he wanted to happen with his art is what has in fact happened.
Well, it was so emotional. I mean, he wrote that art had this power to bring light into darkness and to transform, as you write, you know, suffering into solace, sorrow into rejoicing. And he talked about, he had this term, this idea that das ist het, that is it. Like that it was this, more than a feeling, it was this perception, and he knew it when he saw it. And he said, the world is full of it.
Yeah. It was das ist het, the Dutch for that is it, meaning that an object or a scene or a person could have it, meaning the power to sort of a window into this world of essences, this world of connection to other people, this world of what he would call a sublime, a sense that you're part of a larger world, a larger whole, that you belong and that you have a place both in the present and particularly in the in the future after death. The sense of connection to the past and to the future. And he could see that in a scene, a street side scene with a little girl selling flowers. Mm-hmm. He could see it in a bowl of flowers. He could see it in a garden. He could see it in a starry night sky. And he was often moved by these scenes and admits to basically being taken, brought to the point of tears by his feeling that somehow there was consolation in the night sky. There was consolation in the recognition that these little moments showed him that the world made sense, mm-hmm. that there was the possibility of redemption out there, and that all of his terrible experiences would be wiped out by his ability to connect with this sublime beauty that existed everywhere in nature and in life.
So his paintings were about love.
They were about love. They were about love and consolation. And they both consoled himself. He really consoled himself with his art. And also he wanted to console other people. He saw that as really the highest purpose of religion was consolation. And consolation in the face of the infinite, in the face of death, in the face of life of labor, and that's really what he was constantly trying to do, was get at that sense of creating something that would be both consoling to him and consoling to the people who looked at it.
Gregory White-Smith is with us. He and Stephen Nafee co-wrote Van Gogh: The Life. You can see some of the images of Van Gogh's paintings on our website at KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Gregory White-Smith. He and Stephen Nafee have co-written the book Van Gogh, The Life. Some of the images of Van Gogh's paintings, by the way, are on our website at KUER.org/Radio West. Gregory White-Smith, I wanted to ask you, it's interesting, Van Gogh starts to get a kind of a toehold in Paris, and then very abruptly he leaves. And you say that the real reasons, we don't exactly know why.
Well, he offered a lot of reasons for why he left Paris. The mystery of it is that he had been spending the years before he came to Paris desperately trying to get together with Theo. Yeah. We talked about it earlier, the trying to create this brotherhood of painters and put them together in the same place so they could create these works of objects, these works of art together. And finally, Theo relented and said, well, why don't you come live with me in Paris? And so Vincent came to Paris, and they lived together. And, it was terrible. They had a terrible, they lived, it was like the Odd Couple. Vincent was a mess, and Theo was very, he worked, he had a daily job, and it was very neat and very social. And he couldn't invite people over to the apartment because it was a mess because Vincent left paint everywhere. So they, as we talked about, they had a sort of life where they went out into the bars and they visited the brothels and they did all these things. And Theo got sicker and sicker. Yeah. He had, by this time, contracted syphilis, as three-quarters of adult males in Paris had at that time. And Vincent thought, because he felt, just generally felt guilty, he thought maybe it was his fault that Theo was getting sicker and sicker. And this was after he had his father had died, and the family still blamed him for that. So this terrible image of, oh, my God, am I going to kill my brother, too, gripped him. And in the throes of that, he thought, you know, I really have to leave for Theo's sake. I have to leave Paris. So he tore apart this partnership that he had been trying to put together for years and years and left for southern France, for Provence, and to a place he didn't know and had no friends there. And then proceeded almost immediately to start to write letters to Theo saying, you should come to the south of France, you should come to the south of France. So you can see he was torn always by these great passions, and they weren't always consistent with each other.
Well, of course, he ends up committing himself, as you say, to an asylum in Saint-Rémy and St. Paul's, I guess it is.
Right, St. Paul's. Near Saint-Rémy.
Near Saint-Rémy. And you write about how this kind of new serenity finds its way into his life and into his painting. And you talk about how at this particular time he's working on, you know, a dozen canvases at a time and all of these cypress trees, for example. That's an important motif at the time. And then he comes upon this nighttime study of this single tree silhouetted against, you know, the sky. And this is when we first get the image that comes to, we've come to know as, you know, as the starry
night.
And I wanted to ask you to sort of help us construct that picture as you do in the book. It's important to say that Van Gogh kind of had to superimpose the nighttime sky onto the village of Saint-Rémy because he wasn't allowed to venture out after dark. I mean, he had to imagine or look at the sky
From his barred cell, Well, just a little bit of a predicate on this, and that is that he had wanted to paint A Starry Night for a long time.
Yeah.
And he had done one previous view of A Starry Night when he was in Arles. And one of the reasons was, is a religious reason, and that is he imagined that Christ's visit. There was a visitation by an angel to Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he imagined that that visitation took place in the night under a starry sky. So this image of Starry Night not only had tremendous pictorial and emotional importance for him, it also had a tremendous religious significance. And he had tried a couple of times to paint that precise scene of Christ being visited by the angel under a starry sky, and the paintings had failed terribly, and he had to scrape them off because he was so unhappy with them. So he decided he would just basically drop Christ and the angel out of the picture and just paint the starry night sky. And but he was at, as you say, at Saint-Rémy in his cell, and he had a separate studio, but the studio he couldn't go out of his cell after dark, so he would make sketches of the night sky on one side out his cell window, which I think was facing east, and then when he could go down to his studio, he would add from his sketches into this painting of the starry night sky that emerged from Saint-Rémy. And so what you get in that painting is in that sort of imagined sky, obviously not like a sky anybody has ever seen, but a sense of the intensity of the way he felt under a starry sky and the intensity of a feeling of consolation and reparative inspiration he got under those in that. So it like so much of his art, it's an incredibly intense version of reality. And one of the things, if I can take a second to make this point,
please,
that in the asylum, he did. It's true. He because he had a regimented schedule, because he the money that his brother sent him didn't go through his hands. His brother paid the asylum directly, so he wasn't feeling guilty every day about the money he spent that he wasn't making. He was able to sort of relax and just paint and just look at things. So it was very much just about the art. He didn't have to worry about making shift for himself. We didn't have to worry about neighbors and Arl, who were so incredibly unkind. He made a very funny comment about how much more civil the fellow inmates at San Remy were right. than his neighbors in Arl. And so he really did have a kind of a clear space in which to let his imagination roam. And so he painted these wonderful free, not just the Starry Night, of course, but these wonderful free paintings of cypresses mm-hmm. and fields and mountains that sort of twirl and almost in a fantasy world. So his both his sense of form and his sense of color were freed up as Saint-Remy. And by the fact he didn't, the meals were served at a certain time. Mm-hmm. And so he always liked institutions. Yeah. He liked to go to hospitals and things. But this was his moment of sort of serenity, his brief moment of serenity before the attacks began to descend on him from his TLE, his temporal lobe epilepsy.
Yeah.
And the thing about temporal lobe epilepsy is its primary symptom are these seizures that can come at any time, and they you lose complete control, and when you come out of them, you're unconscious and you don't remember anything that happened. So they're like black holes in your life, and you don't know when they're coming on. They can be sparked by any one of a variety of both psychological factors and physical stimuli. And so what our thought was this, that one of the reasons why those paintings from Saint-Remy and Auvers too, to a certain extent, where he went afterwards, right. have such intensity, is that he really felt when he was looking at an almond branch, for instance, that struck him as beautiful against a blue sky, pink blossoms and a wonderful gnarled gray branch against a bright blue sky. He thought, this could be the last time I see this. I could be struck down in a minute. I could end up shackled to my bed in an isolation cell and never again see an almond branch in blossom. So this is my chance and my only chance to capture this. So he had brought to his seeing a level of intensity that was just, obviously historic and monumental, and we still experience when we see paintings like the almond branches.
Well, and you write that Starry Night and others may have been a reflection of this epilepsy taking a toll on his body, in the sense that you write that his, you put it this way, the euphoric image of that starry sky was really a signal that his defenses had been breached.
Yeah. Well, there is what a temporal lobe epilepsy seizure is a discharge of electrical impulses. Yeah. In the brain, sort of out of control, and it affects temporal lobe, affects the sort of crucial function, higher brain functions of identity and consciousness and self-image and perception. So all those are facilities that really are fundamental to your sense of who you are and your sense of connectedness to your own past and your expectations for the future. And so when that was disrupted, it was dislocating for him in a way that it's very hard for us to imagine. He would come out of it and not know what had happened, but for the one thing he knew is that he had a hole had appeared in his life and he didn't know what happened in it. And so what he found in these images was a chance to again console himself from the inevitability of another attack and to make an ultimate statement on how a starry night can be such a thing of beauty and consolation. And that was his last chance to do that.
You know, we talked earlier about how Theo had said that only by knowing Vincent from the inside could you hope to see his art as Vincent saw it.
Right.
Let me ask you this finally. Do you look at the pictures differently now? I mean, do you think you have some sense in some way of what Vincent saw?
Let me answer the first part of the question. Yes, I look at the paintings completely differently than I used to. And because his mind was so layered and his imagination was so crowded that when you look at a painting, you can see, and there's great joy in seeing what you see.
Yeah.
You see the image, you see the color, you see the forms, you see the playfulness, you see the subject that's depicted. But to know that, to look at some of these famous portraits, how lonely he was, to know that what kind of religious consolation he took in a night sky, to know how he felt connected to people at certain times through the way they, by capturing them on. So you do feel the emotional person in the painting in a way that I didn't before. And I hope, it is certainly our hope, that the readers of the book will come away the same way and their experience of the paintings will be enriched by knowing I think everybody knew, if I can say this, everybody had a rough idea that he was an unhappy person, and a happy person doesn't cut off his own ear.
Yeah.
But and I think that did enrich people's appreciation for the art, that he was able to pull these joyous images out of what was clearly an unhappy life. That much was a part of the biography long before we came along. But I do think that there are richer, more and more layers to that kind of enjoyment and that kind of richness in the canvases. And I think to know them or to sense them, even if you don't know the precise story, know that they're there somewhere, does enhance the experience of the art.
Gregory White Smith, he and Stephen Nafee co-wrote Van Gogh, The Life. He joined us today from a studio in New York City. Gregory White Smith, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tim Slover. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.